Welcome back. I'm Hedrick, and this is Red Ice Radio. Thank you for joining us today. Don't miss our latest video, White Girls, Black Dolls, Destroying White Bias. It's up now on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. It's an investigation into the doll studies that were made in America in the 1940s, and how basically everything that was claimed to have been done by white Americans is now actually being done to them. It's a case study in glaring double standards and contradictions, an issue that many people are completely blind to in these times. We have a show lined up here for you today with Jim Rizzulli. He's behind the video interview series League of Extraordinary Revisionists, talking with people such as Ben Bradbury, author of The Myth of German Villainy, Fred Leuchter, Germar Rudolph, Frederick Tobin, and many more. Now, Jim and his brother Joe are today hardcore revisionists, seeking to hear and also tell us about the German side of the story regarding the claimed atrocities that we are all so very familiar with today. They started out, however, combating the illegal immigrant issue in their hometown, Framingham, Massachusetts, and consequently started a cable TV access show to communicate their concerns. Their immigrant battles led them to the plight of Ernst Zundel in Canada, being prosecuted for having reprinted the book Did 6 Million Really Die?, which turned the entire endeavor towards the issue of the Holocaust. We're going to speak more about that today, and also how these seemingly two disconnected issues are very much connected. He's been banned from Facebook, he's had numerous YouTube accounts shut down in his quest to provide a venue for freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry, and to provide not only a different side of the story on what we're told, but what he obviously believes is the truth. So we're going to hear what Jim has discovered along the way, in particular when it comes to what really happened at Auschwitz. Jim, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for coming on. Pleasure speaking with you today.
Pleasure to be here. I've heard a lot about your program and listened to quite a few shows here and there. So it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Awesome. Well, we have a lot to wade through here today, a lot of heavy topics. But as always, we're not afraid to go deep and dive into the things we need to get answers and to understand why things are the way they are and why the world is the way it is. So why don't we kind of talk a bit about first how you came onto this path that you are on today, Jim, and how you or why you started going into this area to begin with.
Sure. Well, I'm an activist, I guess you could say. I'm a type of guy that I don't like to sit back and just watch things around me go on. I like to say I don't like what's going on here, and I like to say something about it. And I can basically go back to 2003 or 2004, in regards to the immigration issue that happened in my town. It's still happening, actually. And back at that time, my town of Framingham, Massachusetts, it was actually the gateway for illegal immigration in Massachusetts. And the illegal immigrants were coming up here like gangbusters. I heard that they were coming up like 50 a day coming into the town. And then they'd, disperse from there.
Is it a really small town for those who don't know?
No. It's actually Framingham is the largest town in the country. It's got 67,000 people and it's only a town. There are cities that have less people than that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know what the distinction is. I thought it was the population, but I guess there's something else that distinguishes a city from a town.
Well, it has to do with the government, I think.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
If you have a mayor.
Right.
If you have a mayor, I guess it becomes a city form of government. Well, we have town meeting government, so it's a little different.
Right.
But so back at that time, we were noticing that there was a real big influx of people coming into the town. And just abnormal. So we started speaking out about it. Actually, my brother was first involved with it. And he with another fellow, got together and they formed, an organization more or less called CC File, Concerned Citizens and Friends of Illegal Immigration Law Enforcement. Now, the acronym is basically CCFIILE.com. And I actually have a website. That's my website, too.
Yep.
Basically, it was immigration. And, we started, talking about it and we had a meeting about it. We figured we'd get the town people involved. And one day we said, let's go to the library because that's where you meet to get people involved. and we had a meeting. There was only probably 15 people there, but the local newspaper decided to come down and see what was going on. And they saw we were there and what we were talking about. And right off the bat, the next day in the paper, they painted us as a hate group.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Typical. Yeah. So we were painted as a hate group. And we didn't like, you know, particularly the Brazilians were the ones coming into my town. But, you know, we didn't like illegal immigrants and this and that. And right off the bat, it just got us in hot water with everybody in the town, and everybody pegged us as being racist. So that was tie-in with the newspaper and everything around us. But we didn't stop. What we did was we figured we'd make a bigger deal about this. And we did this by a cable show. And we got involved with making a cable show dealing specifically at the time, around 2004 now, dealing with illegal immigration. And we would put that on the TV and that would play. And a lot of people really liked it. They enjoyed what we were doing. We'd go out and interview people on the street. We would talk about the problem. And so this show was on every week. So that was going along pretty well at the time. And then eventually, we worked up to two shows. So we were really out in the main front with the topic. In fact, what happened is any time the news reporters or the TV personalities that were reporting on the topic in Massachusetts anyway, the local TV stations, they would come to me or my brother to talk about it. We were the main people that they would come to in Massachusetts. So, you know, I was on, you know, TV programs, radio programs in the paper. I mean, this was like an ongoing thing that would be happening because we're the only ones that were speaking out against it. So it was going along pretty good. People would, you know, get in contact with me quite a bit and would be talking. And, I guess you could say I was a local celebrity, in around the town. And people would actually, I'd meet people in my local areas, like I'd be in, McDonald's or someplace, and someone would come up to me and start speaking to me. Oh, I saw your show on TV. I like your show. And that was good. So basically immigration at that time was the big deal. It was the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was going along well. Now, what happened after that, because, you know, this is just the beginning of my problems, or our problems anyway. What happened after that was I started to take an interest in immigration in another way. It just so happened one day, you know, because in my town they weren't doing anything about it, and the illegal immigrants can get away with anything. But if you were a white person and you were an illegal immigrant, or something happened to you in immigration issues, they would take care of you pretty quickly and get you out of the country. And one day I noticed in the news or paper, I can't remember when or what it was, I read about this man named Ernst Zundel. And he was getting deported from the United States. And I'm saying, with all these illegal immigrants in the United States, all right, thousands upon thousands of them, here's a white man living at the time in Tennessee, I believe. He gets deported to Canada. And then I said, well, I got to look more into this. So I looked it up and I found out a little bit about Zundel and I read about him. And then all of a sudden, I come to find out that he had a real great interest in the topic of the Holocaust. And that pretty much got me into the Holocaust, because I'm saying, wow, there's more to this than meets the eye. I mean, he's not being deported for immigration issues. He's being deported because someone don't like his stand on the Holocaust. So that's how I got involved with the Holocaust issue. That kind of just, you know, came up. And,
let me ask you about that, Jim. I mean, first of all, why do you think you have the ability to kind of follow through on that? I guess most people would actually be, they would be quite, I guess, scared away from it. They would think, well, what the hell is this? And maybe walk in the opposite direction. But that didn't happen to you.
Well, in a sense, it did. I mean, it was a very controversial topic. I mean, I went into it myself. But here's the thing. Politically, I was very involved politically in the town. I ran for selectman. I ran for state rep. So I didn't want to make this a main topic, even though it became a main topic when I was running. and I really wouldn't say much about it because they try to nail me on it. You know, like when I was running for office, that would be the topic they would bring up because, see, we supported Zundel, all right? And Zundel is a Holocaust denier. So now what happens? You get associated with the person that you're dealing with here. You see, Ernst Zundel is a Holocaust denier, so you must be a Holocaust denier. And that's the thing that they would present in the political arena. So they came after me on that, but I tried to avoid it because I knew that was going to happen. But there was no stopping it. I mean, once they got involved with that political issue of the Holocaust, they used that against me. And then the ADL and the SPLC, the organizations here, you know, in the United States, you're probably, you know, familiar with them.
Sure.
Yeah, they ended up coming after us on the immigration issues and then tying us in with the Holocaust issues. So if you go to the ADL site and the SPLC site, you will find quite a bit of information about us on that site. So, I mean, it's pretty funny, actually. So, you know, in fact, you know what happened to me yesterday? It was kind of interesting. I got a phone call from the TV station. I haven't heard from them in a while. And they were asking me about the topic and saying, you do know you're on the ADL website as a hate group. And I said, well, yeah, I do know that. I'm very proud of that. I look at that as a badge of honor.
Yeah, it should.
You know, so it was kind of funny. He said he might call me back. I really don't know what they're up to. But anyway, I look at being on the SPLC site, the ADLC site, ADL site as a badge of honor, because for them to come after you, that means you're actually getting too close to them. See, that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, they always attack you for, the mildest questioning, the mildest kind of investigations into what actually happened, looking at the available material. What's curious to me about this whole thing, this whole ordeal, is that there is a taboo, even from a historical perspective, just looking at it, right. which should tell people something. It tells you that this is an area they don't want you to look at, and this is an area that they try their very best to smear you in every way possible if you start to approach it. So what kind of things did they make up stuff about you, or did they exaggerate, or what happened?
Well, what happened was they just wanted to nail us into the ground, okay? And so what happened one day from the SPLC guy, there was some fellow, they're from North Carolina or Georgia or somewhere. I don't even remember where they're from. So he wanted to meet us. He wanted to meet my brother and I and interview us, all right? And so I would say, well, look, we have no problem with that. So we said, we'll meet you at McDonald's. But now I said to him, I said, look, if you're going to interview us, I said, we're going to interview you. We're going to have a camera there. We want to get you on camera.
Yeah.
And, see what you have to say. And what happened was he didn't show up.
Of course, yeah.
So he basically knew what we were up to. But he wrote his article anyway. All right, so basically the information that's on the website, the SPLC website, is the information he put together without even talking to us.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is what they do, isn't it? It's just build strawmans and make arguments and assumptions and everything else. Yeah, it's really a shame, to be honest, just over the fact that it's such a sensitive topic that it rarely actually leads to discussions. It rarely actually leads to an intellectual debate on the issues where you can actually weigh claims and counterclaims against each other. It spirals into control, out of control, into some kind of childish, you know, name calling or something. And that's about it, right?
Yeah. So that's basically how they work anyway. They just make a big deal about nothing and, try to get people to look at you in a bad way because you have a brain to examine something. I think that's what bothers me about all this. There's no debate. In other words, wherever you stand on the issue, even if you read the book, if you read a book about it, you're a bad person because you're going above and beyond what you should be doing according to them.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be reading those books or reading anything about the topic. So yeah, that's what they do. They slander, defame you. And there's not much you can do. But that, again, that was just the beginning, okay? It gets worse, right? It gets worse. So what happened after that, I said, well, look, I want to start talking about this on a cable show. You know, this is really good information for people to know, you know. So I think around 2008 or thereabouts, I decided to put this in my cable show. And I remember it specifically. It was show number 86. And we finished off with two. Well, I'll get into that later. But anyway, so that was show number 86. And I started talking about the Holocaust. All right. So, you know, I probably went on for 10 or 15 minutes about something about it. And all hell broke loose after that. Okay. So what happened after that, because now I was on TV, I was talking about the topic. Now, I had a local business. And I used to meet with, local people in the town. We had a business group. I'll mention what the business group is. It was called BNI, business something. I even forgot what it means now. It's been so long. Mm-hmm. But it was a business group, okay? Business Networking International, I think that's what it is. So I was in that group, and, I'd say half the people, there might be 20 people in the group. I'd say half of them probably are Jews. And that, the fact that I was on TV talking about the Holocaust, and there were Jews in that organization, in that group, they were so mad that they wanted me out of the group. And I was one of the first persons in that group. I was in there for 15 years, and I had a good reputation. In fact, three quarters of my customers were Jews. All right. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that was my livelihood, and most of my business, I was working and doing work for Jews. And the reason why the Jews liked me was because I was honest with them. I treated them with respect and how I did my work, and I didn't rip them off. So that's why they liked to use you. Because, see, Jews, what they do is they network. So if you get in with one Jew, you'll get in with all of them, okay? But it works the opposite, too. Okay, it works the opposite. If you get out with them, then you get out with all of them, and that's exactly what happened.
They have more of a tendency to network within the group. They had a level of ethnic interest, which I'd say Europeans overall, as a large group, have kind of really put to the side. Right, we don't have that same level of nepotism or helping each other out on ethnic lines. Right.
Right. Oh yeah, the Jews. I got to give them credit. Okay, when it comes to be together, all right, if the Jews are going to come against someone, they're going to be all united against that person, okay? The only way you defeat the Jews is let them come against themselves, okay? If they had nobody to complain about, then they would destroy themselves.
Yeah, they do argue quite a bit, I've heard, among themselves. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Every group does that, I guess, to a certain extent, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just kind of funny. But anyway, what happened was, they kicked me out of the group, and I lost 75% of my business. And, what are you going to do? I mean, that was that. But it didn't matter to me anyway. Financially, I could get by. And, I was close to retirement age anyway. So, a couple more years went by. I just worked a little bit here and there. I cut my work schedule down like 75% or more. And then I end up retiring. So it didn't matter to me. But the problem is that I would spend now most of my time with my cause, which was the Holocaust in activism and issues and all those type of things. So they actually helped me along in something really positive. So by getting rid of me in those groups,
Right, right. So that's where you've spent the majority of your time and whatnot after that, after all this unfolded?
Oh, yeah. I mean, after that, I had two shows on cable TV. All right. Now, I produce cable shows. That's what I do. I'm a cable producer. So we had two shows on. And what happened was in 2010, they because of our Holocaust stuff, and we were putting in some other pretty good stuff too. They ended up kicking us off the air. Okay, in 2010 they came after us. They took us off the air for a year, and that was very interesting because they really are not supposed to do that. You're supposed to be able to put pretty much anything you want on cable TV as long as they put it in a safe harbor. But they didn't even do that. They just kicked us off. They didn't even give us a chance to go in the safe harbor. And so that was that. They kicked us off for about a year. So we came back, you know, that was 2011. We came back in 2011. And instead of two cable shows now they were our piece. I came back with four cable shows because I was so mad that they had the nerve to do this to me. So I was producing 4-hour cable shows that were on the TV, and they were being shown, if you add them all together, there was probably 12 shows a week being shown at all different times.
Jesus.
So, yeah, my show was blowing them away.
so just to clarify that again, this is sort of as a local show, right? It was kind of an access TV thing, or?
Yeah, I went out to about 100,000 people.
Right. That's pretty good anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I had four shows, and these shows were so powerful. I mean, I had Pierce in it, you know, William Pierce. I had stuff that just blasted the Jews. I mean, it was really quite funny now that I look back on it. I could see the reason why they came after me. But I mean, my shows were just incredible how it went after the Jews. Oh, I put Holocaust stuff in every show. I was pounding them into the ground with my Holocaust stuff. And so we lasted up until 2014. And in fact, July 2014. And they came against us again, accused us of breaking all these rules and regulations at the cable company. And again, that's all they had to do is just move our shows to safe harbor. They took our shows. I've been banned forever.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine. Well, Jim, tell us a bit about some of the material that you came across. Kind of lead us through that a bit in terms of what stood out to you the most. What kind of stuff did you come across that took you in a different direction where you realized that the story that we've been told is not what we think it is?
Well, basically, I mean, you know, I mean, I can get into all that about the Holocaust generally, but I was just concerned. My biggest thing is why are these people so mad about this? You know, why would they ban something on TV? And you're just giving an opinion, or you know, you're giving your information, and you know, then you find out, you know, the things you're saying. Like for instance, you know, when I started really investigating the Holocaust, I got into the subject matters of the camps, and you know, I don't know if you want me to get into specifics. I can really nail it down to you if you want.
Well, I think we should, but if you want to give us an overview first and then we can go deeper into like the issues or something, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, basically I'm a free speech type of guy that I think that, you know, there shouldn't be any stop in anybody's free speech, no matter what they have. I mean,
I agree.
I don't like what the Jews have to say, but you don't see me stopping them. I mean,
they
can say whatever they want. But when it came to the Holocaust topic, I mean, they just didn't want anybody to see it. And, I want to just mention when we had to go before the cable people, you know, because they put us on trial basically, and they had two Jews there. One was a lawyer, and then there was one a woman like a psychiatrist. And their big beef, especially the woman who was the psychiatrist, was that our shows were causing like a traumatic stress upon the people watching it. Imagine that. They felt that, you know, oh, these people are just getting all worked up, and it was traumatic for these Holocaust survivors to watch it.
Why? Because isn't this material pointing to the fact that fewer people died than they say did?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
isn't that funny then?
Yeah. Right. Oh no. It's crazy. So the woman, you know, she made a big deal about that, saying it's traumatic and it shouldn't be on TV.
Right.
And I said, well, that's very simple. Just don't watch it.
That's right. Exactly. You don't have to watch it. Yeah.
You don't have to watch it.
They can't stay away.
Yeah. But, you know, they were just so mad. So the lawyer gets on now, and he, you know, he says that our show shouldn't be on TV because, you know, because the nature of it, and the Holocaust is such an accepted topic that anybody that disagrees with the original topic on the Holocaust must be nuts. I mean, that's basically what he said.
Right.
You're like, we must be crazy. And I'm saying, well, you know, can't crazy people be on TV? I mean, you know, you can say anything you want, right? I mean, if I'm going to be crazy and wrong, why can't I be crazy and wrong?
But right. Are they discriminating all of a sudden?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was just crazy what they did. So basically, they used those two people against me, and I even knew the guy. I was actually friends with him, and I couldn't believe that he actually turned against me. And he's a free speech type of guy too. He's a Jewish guy, but I mean, he's a Jewish lawyer. But you know, he's a conservative Jewish person, and he's asking to see our show. He wanted us to put a disclaimer in it saying that what you're watching now is not true.
right. That's funny. Really?
Wow. So anyway, that's what happened with that.
Yep.
But anyway, but you know, particularly now with the topic of the Holocaust, and I try to tell people when you're dealing with the Holocaust, because I mean, I spend a lot of time on the subject matter now. I mean, I have the whole Holocaust handbook series dealing with the Holocaust every day. That's all I do is read. I've read several books. I read books all the time. I'm always reading about it because I still make video and you know, dealing with the topic. So, you know, I think it's a fascinating topic. But I specifically really deal with Auschwitz because I feel that that's the simplest and the easiest thing for people to look into, mm-hmm. because it was a major camp system there. So that's what I try to do. It's simple. It's not complicated. The information, the camp is still intact. Whereas some of these other camps, like Treblinka and Sobibor and all these other things, they don't exist today. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Nothing there. But the Auschwitz is there. You can walk in there. They give the tours in there, and you can see what's going on. So I like to deal, with Auschwitz because it's simple, and you know, I can get into some basics about it, and showing you why. Why people really should examine that closely, and it's very simple.
Carry us through that, Jim, and we can do it from the point of view of what you learned along the way, or you can just kind of break it down from the top and begin in the area where you think it's most important.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll just break it down. Like if I was going to give a talk about Auschwitz, basically this would be it. If you go to Auschwitz today, most people, first of all, don't. They don't have any clue what it's about. You know, I was listening to a woman on the radio the other day, but it was a video, and she was being interviewed by a revisionist, and she says, "Well, I was in Auschwitz or Buchenwald or something like that." She didn't even know what camp she was in, and this is the problem. Most people don't have any clue about it. I mean, even the people that were there, they don't even know what's going on. So you have to get just some basic things to understand about the camp system, and then you can go from there. So now, again, I never been there, but I've watched the videos, I've watched all their videos, and I've read quite a bit about it. And here's what you have, basically. Auschwitz was not just one camp. It was three camps in Auschwitz. You had Auschwitz I, the main camp, then Auschwitz II, Birkenau, then you had Monowitz, and they were all completely different. All right, so Auschwitz I was the main camp, and you know, you had people that were stationed there, you know, not that many, you know, probably maybe 10,000-20,000 people might have been, you know, there at the most, if that. But the big camp where they said all the people were gassed was actually Birkenau. But I'll get into Birkenau in a second here. So anyway, those three camps, okay? You have Auschwitz I, you have Birkenau, and then you have Monowitz. Now,
yeah, they were connected, right? The Birkenau was actually like the placement, right? This were where all the barracks and stuff like that was, if I remember correctly.
Well, Auschwitz I had barracks too.
Okay.
Okay, but they just didn't have many. But when you see, when they show you all these barracks there's a plane that in one of the videos I saw. That's Birkenau. Birkenau, yeah. Probably had 200 barracks. Huge. I mean, just the thing was just huge. Okay. But Birkenau was actually where most of the sick people went, the older people went, and you know, that was Birkenau. Okay. So anything, you know, when people say it was a place where people were being murdered and this and that, it was just the opposite. they sent the people there that couldn't work, all right? And they had a lot of people there that didn't work, old people and the young people, kids were there and everything. So, you know, they want you to think that when people came into Auschwitz, if they weren't able to work, that they were exterminated, they were gassed and then cremated, but that wasn't the case at all. But anyway, I'll get back to Birkenau. Let me go back to Auschwitz one, because this is the simplest camp to deal with because it still is intact. It has a Crema one, the building there. Now, when you go into that Crema one building, you're going to see it. It just looks kind of weird. It has all these dirt mounds all around it. And, you know, it looks like a bomb shelter. And that's exactly what it was at the end of the war. It was a bomb shelter. And they want you to think that I remember seeing a video of a girl doing the, you know, explaining about it in the camp. You know, they said, what, 4 million people went through Auschwitz. All right. And they made it look like all the people went through that camp there. But that building there was not made. It was not capable or made for gassing people. All right. At all. I mean, you know, you go inside it, you know, they chopped holes in the roof at the end, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, there's no way people were killed in that building. So they want you to believe that this is the building that people were gassed in. And, you know, when you go through, I don't even think they give you the tour like they did anymore. They cut you off from some rooms. But it just wasn't feasible that people were gassed in that building. And you could see it by looking at it. So anyway, I mean, you have to see the building. You have to look at the video, look at pictures, and you'll see for yourself that, you know, there was no way that could happen. It was an all big cement building inside. It was all cement. Eventually, they knocked down the walls way in the beginning, you know, because they used to have, you know, rooms. It was partitioned off with several rooms from the original plan. They cut the walls down. And another thing that people don't understand, too, who's the they? Who did all this?
Mm-hmm.
Auschwitz, when it was taken over, you know, in the beginning, was taken over by the Russians. All right. The Americans didn't get into Auschwitz until a year later. And people don't know that. They think that, oh, the Americans went into Auschwitz right off the bat. No, the Russians had 10 years to make that camp what they wanted to make it. I call it the, you know, horror Disneyland.
10 years, not 1 year?
No, 10 years.
10 years.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. But the Americans didn't get into Auschwitz until 10 years later.
10 years. But, wow, it's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was incredible. And so they had all this time to just fix Crema 1, that building, and make it look like it was a gas chamber. All right. You know, and that's how they present it today. And they, you know, they presented it as being the first people were gassed in the beginning.
Now, tell us why do you think the Soviets would do that? Why would they come up with such a lie?
Well, because first of all, they already have the lie. The whole thing has already been played out, what they wanted this to all look like. So they had to make it look like the Germans were bad guys. And they were, you know, these guys were the Huns, you know what I mean? They were sticking people with their bayonets and throwing the babies into the crematoria, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they had to have something there to show for it. So they made Auschwitz 1, okay, Auschwitz 1, making it look like horror Disneyland. So now when the Americans got there, okay, they already had the story that 4 million people were killed there. They already had the story. So they had to make the place fit the story. So that's exactly what they did. So now, you know, once they started taking the Americans on the tours there, showing the Americans what it was like, the thing was already set up as being horror Disney World. Okay. So, you know, people would be told that this is what happened there. Remember, there was no holes in the roof of Crema 1. They chipped the holes in later. It was concrete. I mean, they chipped them in later, saying that, you know, the Germans threw in Zyklon B through these holes. So, I mean, the whole thing was all fabricated. And, you know, they were presenting Crema 1 as basically being, the you know, a real gas chamber from that day. But it wasn't. It was all after the war. It was all fabricated and made to look like something, you know, nefarious happened there. So that it didn't happen. They put the big, you know, next to Crema 1, they put a big chimney you know, a really big chimney that doesn't connect to anything. All that was done after the war, but yet they were making it look like this is an original building. And, you know, the Germans were killing people in this building in the beginning. So it's just absolutely ridiculous to see that was even the case. It wasn't the case at all. I mean, it was just a building that had many uses. In the beginning, it was used as a coal. They had coal stored there. It was used as a place to do emergency, you know, stuff on people if they got hurt, you know, medical stuff. It was used for several different things, and it ended up being a bomb shelter at the end, because people don't realize this either, that Auschwitz was actually bombed, and they took some casualties. Some of the people in the camp did die, you know, because of bombings there.
Well, wasn't there, I don't know exactly all the numbers, how they divide up between the different work camps and all that stuff, but obviously there was an awful lot of people that died towards the end of the war at these camps due to, well, various issues, right? From disease to food supplies and everything else, resources, medicine being cut off, right?
Right. Well, what happened, what happened in the camps, basically in all the camps, the Americans and the British were bombing all the railroads, and they were bombing anything that came in, you know, to try to, you know, starve these people out or whatever. And they did a good job at it, because no supplies got in, no medical supplies got in. And in all the pictures that you see of people being skin and bones and all that, most of that all happened at the end of the war. You know, the last month of the war, all that happened. So, but getting back to Auschwitz I, when the Russians got into Auschwitz I, you know, there were people that died, sure, but there was nothing compared to what they said died. I mean, you know, the Russians made up this concoction of a story that, you know, four million people died there. All right. I mean, they came up with that ridiculous story in the beginning, and they got everybody to believe it.
And they had to retract. How many? 3 or 2.5 million? They retracted from that later, right? Or was it what?
Well, what happened was they said 4 million, and then you know, because of the revisionists now going after them, saying that's ridiculous, they lowered the figure to 1.1 million.
That's a lot. I mean, think about that. Just spend a minute on that. That's removing, you know, almost 3 million people. Right. And even that as a accusation against someone is that's unfathomable. Claiming that it was 3 million people killed, more than, you know, than the actual claim, right?
Yeah, and they kept the original 6 million.
Okay. Exactly, they've still kept that. That's true.
Yeah. So yeah, that's basic. But again, that was all set up by the Russians. Okay, so now, you know, they find out. Oh, okay. So the plaque, you know, the original plaque in Auschwitz up till 1990, you know, said 4 million people were killed here. Okay, 4 million, you know, Jews or whatever you want to say. I guess I don't think that includes everybody, but 4 million people were killed there. So then, you know, they had to make a new plaque. So when the Pope came back, you know, a little after 90, they had to make, I think 89, I think it was, or 90. The Pope comes and they change the plaque, and now they say, you know, 1.1 million. And of course, as it went on, you know, certain people would write about the topic because of the revisionists, and they would still, even Van Pelt, who did a lot of writing, pro-Holocaust writing, he even admitted 600,000 people were killed there. In other words, it went down from 4 million to 600,000, and it continues to go down and down and down. And basically today, the figure that I come up with anyway, they say about 78,000 people died in Auschwitz, and half of them might have been Jews.
And that was then through disease and these kinds of things, or?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. That included whatever. I mean, you know, 78,000, and this included everything. I mean, you know, how will they die with disease or this and that? Now, in all the camps, okay, if you're dealing with Auschwitz and all the camps, remember, you know, they had a good amount of camps all spread out through Germany and throughout in Poland. But basically, it came down to six major camps that they claim people were exterminated in. But anyway, so, you know, they say that approximately with all the camps, maybe 350,000 people died complete. And, you know, it might have been half again that were Jews. All right. Now, this is being killed with all causes, okay? Sickness, death, disease, people being shot. You know, again, you know, people were shot and people were killed because some of the camps, some of these camps, some people were criminals and they did things wrong. So, you know, things happen.
And it was, obviously, we got to explain that too to our audience, that these were work camps. They were labor camps. This is where Germany managed to produce a lot of things that they needed for the war. Just this concept that the interest was to, you know, house these people, clothe them, shave their heads, shuffle them through these different facilities and whatnot, as opposed to using them for labor, which was a much needed thing that they wanted at the time, is ridiculous in itself, right? That they even had time to spend, efforts on these various, torture campaigns and electrified floors and, all these kinds of outrageous claims that has come out from some of these testimonies from people who said they were there, right?
Right. Yeah. It's just amazing that people don't understand the camp system. They just don't understand that Auschwitz, again, was basically a work camp, especially Monowitz, where they were working it was called the Buna factory, actually. And they were trying to actually make synthetic rubber. Because at the end of the war, Germany couldn't get rubber, okay? Because, they cut them off from rubber. Mm-hmm. And so Monowitz was the place where they were experimenting and making rubber and synthetic, I think even synthetic fuel, too. So that was like a big deal there. So that was just a big, huge, there could have been 20,000 people working in Monowitz, that was shuffling between the camps. All three camps, they would go to work every day and come back. So there was a tremendous amount of people. I think, in the whole Auschwitz camp system, I would say there's probably 200,000 people that probably ran through it. You know what I mean? From mm-hmm. beginning to end,
right.
It was probably about 200,000. But again, they weren't all there at once, but I mean, they were coming and going. They were being shifted to other camps all over Germany and Poland and all these places. So, again, why would the Germans spend all this time and money to bring all these people there, just to kill them? I mean, it would make no sense. It just doesn't make any sense. And house them, especially in Birkenau, with all the barracks there. And then, of course, these facilities had all the amenities that a town would have. They had the best hospitals. Anything that you'd see in your town. I mean, you could mail things in the town. They had opera.
They had their own money, right?
Yeah, they had it was called concentration camp money because they did get a stipend, a little bit of money they could spend.
Yeah.
These people, they came and went in these camps. Some of these people, came into Auschwitz to work and then they went home at night. I mean, they didn't all stay in Auschwitz. I mean, people were coming and going all the time. So if there was some sort of a mechanism for murdering all these people, don't you think there would have been, an outcry from people coming and going, telling you what was going on in the camps?
Now, are there eyewitnesses or people that stated this? Are there sources to get a hold on that has this information?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you interview people, well, you can't because they're probably most of them are dead yet, but the real truthful people that were in these camps, like Thies Christensen, his name was, or something like that. There were some people that were stationed in the camps and they said nothing happened. Okay.
Right,
so, I mean, but they never, you never hear from them. You know what I mean?
No, of course you got to control the message. I mean, and obviously there were, ovens at Auschwitz. There were bodies were being cremated, and I think practically all around the clock, probably because of disease and typhus and these issues. Right? I don't know how many ovens they had in total, but
I can tell you what's going on.
Sure.
There.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. In all the camps, all three of the camps, Auschwitz one had an oven there. They had ovens there. Okay. I know they had at least two. But in all the camps, there was probably around 52 crematoria in all the camps, okay? And they weren't all functioning well at the same time. I mean, they had breakdowns in these and everything. So they weren't all functioning, all right? Auschwitz I was done with in 43. I mean, that camp was all, you know, there was nothing else going on there, Auschwitz I. They closed that down. Well, they didn't close it down, but, you know, it wasn't in operation anymore from the aspect of what people think. So basically, Birkenau and Monowitz were going after that. But the crematoria, what happened there is, since they had such an outbreak of typhus in the camps, you know, they had to build a lot of crematoria. And again, 50 crematoria wasn't even enough for them to deal with, you know, a couple hundred people a day were dying, you know, because of the sickness of typhus and all this and that. And even with that, they couldn't keep up with it. You know what I mean? They right, couldn't even right. keep up with that, you know, with all these, crematoria, because again, they weren't all functioning at the same time. Some of them worked, some of them didn't, and this and that. So people don't really understand, you know, how the process worked. But, you know, the Germans, they tried their best to contain the problem, you know, keeping these people healthy. And that's what people don't understand. If anything, the Germans did with the Jews, they actually kept them alive. And if they weren't in those camps, I would guarantee most of them probably would have died outside the camps.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, just this aspect, that's why this is such a outrageous story to people who've never heard it before, because it goes contrary to so many things that they've heard. That the very aspect that the reason why they shaved their hair, the reason why they issued clothes to them, you know, and took their shoes, all these things, was obviously down to try to control the typhus issue. Yeah. of these right. Little parasites and whatnot. And on top of that, you have the issue, of course, of the Zyklon B and whatnot that was actually used to fumigate right. clothing and all these other issues. Tell us a bit about that and the, you know, these things that we see with the blue on the wall and all that stuff.
Sure. First of all, let me just preface that to show that Himmler was in charge of all this. Okay. You know, they make him look like he was the bad guy, but he was back in 42 when they were having the typhus epidemics there. He was head of the camp administration. And he said, to them there, he goes, look at you, you have a high death rate due to the disease. And he goes, you have to do something to reduce the disease. And so, you know, what they started doing was they started feeding the people better and you know, giving them things that would, so they wouldn't die as quick. But again, part of that was the fumigation, you know, to really get cooking on this fumigation. Now, you know, a lot of people, most of the people today feel that, you know, the Jews were gassed in these gas chambers, but it's just the opposite. What happened was they were using the Zyklon B, obviously, to fumigate all the barracks and all these places, the clothes and everything, to keep these people alive. And when you go on tours of Auschwitz today, they never show you those, fumigation places. You know, and the fumigation in Auschwitz I, I believe the biggest building in Auschwitz I, other than the kitchen, was the fumigation building. And you never see it. It's never shown to anybody. Okay. And yet they have this huge fumigation complex that took all the people's clothes, fumigated all the clothes, fumigating all the bedding and everything. So the Germans really, really worked hard to keep these people alive because, you know, again, they had to use them, you know, for work and they wanted them to work. But again, they, you know, they make this crazy story up that, you know, the people were being gassed and being killed. You know, all the propaganda was being spread all through the camps from day one. And so that's the message that it got out, even though, you know, you can't prove that anybody was gassed because there was no homicidal gas chambers. And that's the bottom line.
Now, did the Americans and the British decide to go along with what the Soviets were kind of conjuring up at the time? Or do you think that there was an agreement? It's very difficult to know, but do you think there was any kind of agreement between the Soviets?
Oh, no, they were all in cahoots. And in fact, the Americans, they dropped leaflets on Auschwitz saying that people were being gassed.
Oh, they did. I didn't know that.
They dropped leaflets saying that, you know, this is, you know, they had to spread this propaganda lie. And so, oh, you know, people are being gassed in gas chambers and this and that. So, you know, when the people came into these camps, they honestly thought that that's what was going to happen to them. And then when they went into the showers, and they took the showers, you know, they thought they were going to be gassed, but they weren't gassed. They took real showers. You know, so they were kind of
the famous testimony with Irene Sisblatt, whatever her name is. She says it was a miracle. Water came out instead of the gas. You know, it's like, ouch. You know, it's amazing that Spielberg included that in his movies, right?
Oh yeah, that was that. I actually watched that, I think, the other day. It was really silly, wasn't it?
It's remarkable with the you know, with the diamonds and all that stuff, and defecating them and eating them again, and all that stuff.
that's just plain. You got to remember that diamond thing that happened over a period of 3 years, you know.
Okay. So, yeah.
It didn't just happen like she swallowed the diamonds, then she crapped them out. Oh no! She swallowed those diamonds, and those diamonds worked their way out over a couple years.
So is that true, or did she actually do that?
What's that?
Did she actually do that, or is that just made up?
Oh no. Well, you know, that's a good question. If that was true or not,
I think it's made. I think it's made up.
It wasn't true. It wasn't true that it happened over 3 years. But I mean, she probably did. You know, that's a good question to ask. I don't think she did it at all. But,
right.
You know,
I don't think so either. I don't know.
I don't think so either. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not saying she couldn't have done it at one time, but over 3 years, no, it's impossible for that to happen. I mean, if she did it in one day, well, you know, within 2 or 3 days, you know, I can see that happening, but no, I not for 3 years.
So the eyewitness testimony that we get, it varies tremendously. There's, maybe we can talk about some other examples that you... that are close at heart or close, you know, on the top of your head of examples. But the point we try to get across here is that there were rumors going on already before people arrived at these camps, suspicions. They thought what was going to happen, etc. Because,
right,
you know, we have so many survivors coming out afterwards and saying, well, yeah, but I was there, you know, I saw it, or I survived, or etc. But as some other revisionists have pointed out, there isn't a single one that has seen or been in the gas chambers and all that stuff and actually come out to see that, right, alive.
Yeah, that's the thing that really is disturbing about this. There is not one real eyewitness that saw anything. Okay, they saw a lot of things, but they didn't see that happen. Okay. Nobody ever saw anybody gasp because it didn't happen. Now, what they must have done, this is my theory on what happened, because I was reading about this in one of the books the other day, and it was saying that in Birkenau crematorium 2 and 3, they threw the bodies in the morgue. Okay, they had like the underground morgues, and they had to be a cool space to put them in. So what they probably saw was, there was probably like, you know, a whole bunch of bodies in the morgue. And then what they did is they actually fumigated the morgue with the bodies in it.
Right.
That's what probably happened. That's what probably they saw. In other words, the bodies were already dead. The people were already dead. They already died of sickness and disease. They were waiting in the morgue to go to the crematoria. And so they fumigated, you know, the area. And people, you know, you might have had somebody that saw, oh, I saw, you know, the gas coming out of a cloud, I don't know, whatever. And, they might have thought that what was happening. You see what I'm saying?
Right, exactly. And, you know, there's even concepts of, you know, that the hot water, the boiler system has been shown as some kind of device in the gas chambers and all this stuff. But this was probably hot, scorching water that was coming out. There are actually these images, these drawings of kind of gas coming out with the water and stuff like that, right? Like kind of depictions of what was happening at the time. But I can imagine it was probably pretty cold at that time. And you know, in that, they had some gruesome winters in that part of the world too at that time. And, you know, it probably was plenty of steam even coming out from these showers, you know? Like,
yeah, you're right. I mean, that could have been, I never really thought of that one. That's a good point. Especially if they had windows and they opened a window, right? I mean, you open it and the steam comes out of the window. That's possible. I know in Medadnik that, you know, those places were right where everybody could see them. So that could have happened there.
Yeah, Majdanek is a very, it's also, that exposes the thing even further, I think, when you examine that, you know. But I can't recall exactly some of the issues that were, or some of the construction at Auschwitz versus Majdanek, but I've looked at both and I might be confusing a couple of things, but largely, they were, you know, kind of set up the same as far as I understand it.
Yeah. Well, my Dyadic buildings were, you know, they looked like a regular building, like a house, kind of like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but long. Whereas Auschwitz, the buildings are more concrete-ish, you know what I mean? And that's why when they, you know, blew them up, but I don't know who blew them up, to be honest with you. I think the Russians did. Some people think the Germans did. But anyway, Crema 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, especially 2 and 3, you know, were blown up. And if you go look at them, it's all concrete. Everything's concrete around there, you know. But anyway, getting back to what you were saying about the people already were already predisposed of thinking that they were going to be gassed or killed. So when they went into the camp system, they already had that in their brains. So with all these things, all these rumors were spreading. You see what I'm saying? So people on the outside now would hear these things and people went into the camps. The Red Cross goes into the camps and they look around. They see what's going on. You didn't see them say anything about homicidal gas chambers. How could you hide that from them? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't hide something like that from them. So the Red Cross, you know, they write up a report, you know, people dying, they're getting sick. And, you know, there was nothing written up bad about what was going on in the camps. You know, the Red Cross brought stuff into the camps, supplies to help the people, to feed the people. You know, where was the big problem? There was no big problem.
I know it's remarkable. They came out with the report after the war and people can, you know, can read that to this day. I wanted to ask you, we're going to take a break here a little bit, but basically in terms of the eyewitness, the testimony that we get and whatnot, do you think that a lot of people, are there some that knowingly are lying, or do you think that most of them are kind of, they were convinced to a certain degree that it was happening and they have been kind of, I can't even remember as a kid sometimes, some things you were, you know, you're kind of drawn into it, you're thinking about stuff and it almost like you end up believing yourself. I don't know if they,
well, right. Know. No, that's a real good point. But see, the mind can play tricks on you. And here's what happens. This is my opinion. I think what happened was with a lot of these people, because they were, you know, they heard all this propaganda, all these horror stories. I wouldn't doubt that some of them started dreaming all this in their dreams. Okay. So then when it came to tell the story, they just incorporated their dreams and they actually believed what they dreamt.
Yeah. Wasn't there someone said, it was real to me. I forget who said that.
I know Rosenblatt in one of his interviews, you know, he said something about something like that too. You know, they asked him, how come you said something if it wasn't true? And he goes, well, I wanted it to be real or it was real to me. I remember something to that effect. But no, but I can understand. See, the mind is very interesting, you know, because if they already had nightmares about what was going to happen to them, I'm sure a lot of those nightmare scenarios came out when they gave their testimony when they were talking to Spielberg. Remember Spielberg, you know, he said he interviewed 50,000 people, you know, to do his show, you know, baloney, his show.
By the way, do you know if those are available, like archives, and where does
have them? You could probably get them. I'm not sure what university it had, but I remember one of the revisionists who does videos. I don't know if it was Eric Hunt or I forgot which one. It might have been Eric Hunt. He was actually getting into all that stuff, going into the original videos and stuff. And once they found out who he was, they kicked him out of the building. So.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Well, let's take a short break right here, and then we can continue and pick up in the second. There's a lot of interesting things I want to get into, and we are, of course, far away from talking about the various issues here. But give us some of the websites first, Jim, so people know where to go if they want to follow your work, and if there's something there you'd like to recommend to them, or if you have any material available you'd like to mention.
Okay, my website is ccfiile.com, all right? And that has, I have a lot of stuff about immigration in Holocaust links. My other site is Rizzoli TV, RIZOLITV.com. And those are good sites. I mean, my sites. And then you have the IHR.org, the VHO.org. Those are really good sites to go to too. The CODA site, CODOH. I think it's .org too. I'm not 100% sure. It's either karma.org. So those are really good sites to get started. And then just doing any search, putting in Holocaust hoax, you know, Holocaust lies, or anything like that will get you into all the videos. My videos, to find my videos, you just have to do a search for my name, Jim Rizzoli, R-I-Z-O-L-I, and you'll come up with all my videos. I have hundreds of videos. I have all over the internet, and a lot of different accounts, YouTube accounts, where all my videos are. You'll come up against them or find them somewhere. So
yeah, exactly. And definitely, folks, do check out The League of Extraordinary Revisionists, some great videos in kind of a series that Jim has been doing as well. We'll make sure to add a link to his YouTube channel so you can check those out. He did one with Ben Bradbury a little bit not too long ago, which is, of course, the author of The Myth of German Villainy. Really good book.
Yeah, yeah. Have you interviewed him?
I haven't. I'd love to get him on, by the way. So maybe we can...
Oh, my God. He is good. I mean, that guy is smart as a whip, this guy. I'm telling you. You're definitely going to have him on. Boy.
We should do... I might extend to... We can talk about that later, but I'd like to extend a kind of an invite to you together with a few other people that you've involved. Maybe we can do a group, a round table or something and talk about
sure.
the good stuff.
Oh, yeah, that'd be
great. Yeah, it would be great. All right, well, Jim, we'll make sure to have the links up to your websites. We'll just take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with Jim Rizzoli.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Tune in to the second hour of this show at redicemembers.com, where you can hear all our shows, see all our films, videos, and insight episodes. You can stream or download. We have RSS feeds available as well, so that you can download any shows to your mobile device with a podcast app, also known as a podcatcher. And we have some recommendations on podcast apps and also how to go about that in our FAQ on redicemembers.com. When we pick up, we will continue the story with Jim regarding the claims of what happened at Auschwitz, some of the more outrageous claims that hasn't actually been verified or cross-correlated with other eyewitnesses, despite the fact that this is one of the biggest crimes in human history, at least as far as we're told. No, instead, what the powers have done is simply to make it forbidden to question the stories that we hear, at least in many countries. And if it's not directly against the law, it is enough of a social taboo that it probably most likely will lead to your livelihood being destroyed. This is effectively serving as a threat so that we won't look into the counterclaims for ourselves and look at some of the material that some of these prolific researchers have provided for us. We extend the conversation to both legal and illegal immigration, and we discuss how the topics are glued together by the issue of guilt and blame. So stay with us, redicemembers.com. Go there, sign up, and tune in. You'll get access to a massive archive and growing by 3 shows every week. We have updates planned for the main website, and then we're going to give the members site a much-needed facelift and back-end improvement as well. We have some real exciting developments and new additions coming up. Your support helps us grow, improve, expand, and keep all of this stuff free from commercial interruptions. Thank you for listening and for considering a membership. We'll speak to you right after the break.